Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, talking home renovation, repair, water, inspection issues with our two guests who are regulars on our program, Kit Adams of Adams Design and Construction in Madison and John Freiberger of Freiberger Consulting of Fitchburg. Really pleased to have Ken and John back to talk about all those kinds of things that happen around the home that maybe you'd like to get fixed. Maybe you want to do some remodeling, repair issues. Maybe there's a water problem. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Ken, good to have you back.
It's wonderful to be here.
And
nice
John,
to see you.
Yeah, great to see you as well.
Good to be here again.
We had an email from Lori who wondered if a layer of newspaper found in the first layer of insulation in a 50-year-old attic is a fire hazard.
Well, the answer to that is not unless it catches fire. It was commonly done. It's well protected from the plaster below, and the insulation above. I wouldn't worry about it too much. People used paper quite often 50, 60 years ago, thinking that it might be a good insulator, and indeed it turned out to be, because cellulose insulation is basically treated crumbled up newspapers, and it's very good, but it's been treated so it doesn't catch fire as readily. I wouldn't worry about it at this point.
Linda emails John about condensation on their windows, which were replaced along with the siding this summer. She wonders if she should keep her thermostat at a constant temperature or not set to lower temperature at night when people are not at home. Does this make a difference in terms of condensation?
It does make a difference. The lower the temperature is, the more likely you are to get condensation. But rather than waste energy by not using your setback thermostat at night, I think you want to try to find out what Linda has in her house for relative humidity. And buying an inexpensive humidistat would be a place to start. If she's 40% or over, she is going to get condensation on the windows almost certainly, because the windows will condense when they hit about 32 degrees. So try to lower the humidity in the house. Make sure you've got good exhaust fans. Take a look at cooking. Maybe you have a lot of pets. Maybe you're stacking firewood in the basement, which is a great way of getting moisture into the house. Maybe your basement is damp because the gutters aren't very good and you're taking in some humidity through the walls. So rather than lower the temperature, let's try to lower the humidity and save some money that way.
Bonnie emailed from Mount Horeb wondering how much should a wood door give during the winter months when it's below 30 degrees. Is a quarter of an inch okay for an outside door? Will a blower test of a front door reveal if it leaks?
Well, it's my turn.
Ken, go ahead.
Okay, sure. First of all, a blower door will do a very good job of telling you if the door is leaking, if the seal's broken, and so forth. Wood is a living thing, and it is a natural product, and it does expand and contract as the temperature and humidity changes. So what you can expect that what you want to do is you want to make sure the door is either painted or stained all the way around, and that's all six edges of it, because wood will absorb more moisture in areas that are unfinished. It's very uncommon, or it's very common actually, to open up a door that's 30, 40 years old and the edges aren't finished, especially the top or bottom edge. So it's a good thing to have a coat of finish on. You don't want to do it on a day like today.
No.
You don't want to have that door open. But a blower door test is a great thing to do for a variety of reasons. You could find cold spots in the house. You can come up with a long-range plan of how you're going to make your home more energy efficient. So good luck to you.
Let's go to the phones now. And Ken in New Berlin. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
During the construction of my home, we had an unseasonably great amount of rain. And areas of my, it's a one-story home, areas of the house that where I have ceramic flooring have a pine underlayment. And some mold formed on that pine underlayment that's visible from the basement. Should I remove it, and how should I remove it?
So you can see, Ken, you can see basically gray patches on the underside of the floor.
Just the pine underlayment areas. The underlayment areas that are plywood have no problem.
Okay. Well, good. It sounds like now this is you have to have 70% humidity for a mold to grow on an organic surface. So you're not going to worry about that mold coming back and you know, starting to spore and things again. So I think simply washing it is a good way to go. In the old days, we used to tell people to use a 10% bleach solution, but then you start worrying about all the chemicals in bleach. I've been telling people just to go ahead and use like Dawn dishwashing detergent and wipe it down. That's going to get almost all of it off, and I think that's about as far as you probably need to go. It'll make it look a little bit better, and should something ever get wet again, you won't have any spores there that could regrow.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks, Ken. Thank you for calling. Jane in Plover, we turn to you now. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a dilemma, and I don't know if these guys will be able to help me figure it out, but maybe
okay.
They will.
All right.
I bought a house way back in 1994, and it's an old house, and it was bought and sold without a realtor in a very short amount of time. And when I moved in, after the furniture was all pulled out, I noticed that there were places on the drywall where there was rotting. So I got a community development loan, and we did some fixing up and pulling out of old insulation and gutting it, basically, and putting in new drywall. Well, I got the same problem again. And short of bulldozing the house,
yeah.
Don't know what to do about it. I also now have carpenter ants because of the problem.
Okay. Oh, we've got moisture there, Jane.
Yeah, there's moisture.
Yeah, so I don't
right.
know what to do. I have a feeling that it has something to do with the fact that the eaves were on this house when it was originally built were very, very short, not very long.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's any ice melt or water or anything like that, that's where it's coming in, I believe. But
well, that's
there's
possible.
Something I can do.
Jane, do you know about how old the house is? You said it was old, but you didn't say how old. Turn of the last century, or?
Yeah, I think it was probably built in the late 40s, maybe, late 30s.
Oh, in the 1930s or 1940s?
Yeah.
Okay, so not terribly old then.
No.
So that,
okay.
That would mean she has no overhangs. That was pretty common at that period.
Yes.
I hardly have any overhangs,
right.
I'm telling
yeah.
you. It's probably maybe 6 inches on some sides and less.
Yeah, I think we want to eliminate the possibility that there's no water barrier on the house. So you're going to need to pop loose a piece of siding and see if there's felt or something underneath that siding. If there isn't any, and we do see houses in the 30s because of the Depression and in the 40s right after the war because you couldn't get anything as far as building materials, where occasionally we have inadequate water barriers. My guess is your house probably has a water barrier on the wall and that your analysis of an eave problem is probably correct. But eaves can be built out and extended. You might want to have either a real knowledgeable contractor or even a local architect or engineer make a drawing for you and extend the eaves. I had to do that on my barn. My
wow.
barn had no eaves at all. And when I started taking the siding off to reside it, I found that about a third of the structure was just plain gone. And so I ended up extending them.
I still have rotten wood and carpenter ants. And so if it's a pretty big problem, is it even worth doing all of that? Because I'm on a very limited income as well.
Can I ask, what type of siding do you have?
They put metal siding on it.
Did they put it over the original?
I don't know because I've never really looked under there. It was that way when I bought it.
I've run into this problem a couple of times on houses that were built in the 40s that were remodeled in the 80s, and they put siding over the top of the existing siding, and at the top of the siding where they terminate it, there's a place for water to actually run in front of the fascia, behind the siding, run down the wall and find its way in and not actually be able to get out. That would be a good place to start looking.
Okay. The other question, though, then, is that I still have that rotten wood and the carpenter ants. Is there anything
well,
to do about that?
Jane, maybe that's just localized. You know, if it's in one small area, then you should be able to take care of it. I mean, one thing you might want to think about doing is actually get a local building inspector in.
That's a good idea.
Get a state-registered home inspector and just tell them you've got problems because home inspectors are pretty good. I mean, this is one of the things we're supposed to do. We're supposed to ferret out water problems before you buy the house. And just for a couple of $100, this person, a home inspector, can probably go over this exterior And, you know, because Ken and I are sort of guessing since we're not there and don't have pictures or anything, and start with that. And home inspectors often can give you good advice on how to cure problems easily and cheaply as well.
Okay.
So why don't you start there? It might cost you $200, $250 to do a partial inspection, but then you've got a professional who's actually on site and can talk to you. And most home inspectors are pretty resourceful.
Okay.
All right. Give it a shot.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And good luck, as Ken says. Debbie in Kenosha, on to you. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
My problem is water damage in my basement. I had some problems with some malfunctioning of my sump pump and came home one day and the basement was underwater. The problem I have is I had linoleum tile down there that the previous owner installed.
Yeah.
And it was coming up and it was breaking and cracking, and I had that all pulled up. I have it all pulled up. Now it's just plain cement, but you can see where the tiles were, and I'm wondering, do I have to treat the cement with anything, or I'm planning on selling the home.
You're not seeing glue, you're just seeing spots, or is there some...
You can see, I think it's the adhesive that you're seeing, because it looks like a checkerboard.
Oh, sure, that's the adhesive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, do you know how old the vinyl was, the linoleum?
I don't.
Floor?
I want to say this home was built in the 60s, okay. And I think, you know, I want to say at least 15 or 20 years old.
There's a couple things you can do, but before I do anything, I would take and scrape a small amount, bag it up carefully, and take it to have it tested to see if there's asbestos in the adhesive. There's quite often asbestos in adhesive and in the linoleum, and so since you've been able to sort of get it up by accidentally soaking it in water, that takes care of the linoleum. But the adhesive, if you start scraping that, and if there are hazardous materials in there, you could cause yourself some harm, and you don't want to do that.
Okay.
If there's not, there's a couple things that you can do. One would be to lay something else down, but another one might be to scrape the floor either by hand, or they have machines that are available for rent that you could actually scrape the floor up and do a pretty nice job of cleaning it up.
Okay.
Okay.
There are some cracks in the cement as well.
Yeah. No,
do I need to worry about that?
If you can't put your finger in them, if they're not that big, or if they haven't separated so that one level, one side is higher than the other, I wouldn't worry about it. All
okay.
Concrete cracks. You know, if you ever look on a sidewalk, you see every so often there's a little indentation they put into, so you could see like a sidewalk panel.
Sure.
They do that because they're trying to control where the sidewalk's going to crack. Doesn't always work, but that's the idea. Concrete cracks.
Where do I get the adhesive tested?
Let's see. Where are you located? You're in Kenosha.
Kenosha.
State hygiene.
The state hygiene.
Yeah.
State hygiene.
Test. You might have to mail it off.
It's in Madison.
Into Madison. But there might be somebody local. You could do a little web search and see if there's someone local. I think it's around $40-$50 to have it tested.
Okay.
Maybe a little more.
But well worth it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You don't want to mess around if there's hazardous materials in there.
Okay. And that would be depending upon how old the linoleum and the tile is and the adhesive, correct?
Well, the older the adhesive was and the older the linoleum is, the more likely. But I would check it. I wouldn't guess saying, well, it's on the edge, it might be, you know, it might be okay. I would go follow it through.
All right.
Okay.
Good luck.
Okay.
Yeah, bye.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Ken Adams of Adams Design and Construction, John Freiberger of Freiberger Consulting of Fitchburg, our guests here as we talk home renovation and repair on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer. We'll take some more calls now with Ken and with John. Nick in Richfield up next. Nick, hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for the show.
Sure.
My question is, I have a 50s cape, and I want to insulate the upper rafters, and I was going to put vent tubes in and then run, like, R19 craft insulation. And is there any, like, side effects or anything else I should consider when doing this?
Well, you just want to make sure that you've got good ventilation going on, Nick. I'm going to refer you to a website if you've got a pencil there.
Okay.
There's a real useful website called coravent.com. It's C-O-R and then a dash and then an A and then another dash, V-E-N-T.com. They've got nice cross-sectional drawings. I think they've even got one of a Cape Cod because the Cape Cods have those sloped second-floor ceilings that are hard to deal with. And they have worksheets and all kinds of things that you can download and sort of figure out how much venting you need. So it'll give you a real professional start. So when you talk to your insulator, you've got things that you can show them. It sounds like you're going to put the chutes in, which is a real good idea. Make sure you've got enough venting, and then get in as much insulation as you can. Talk to the insulator about possibly doing tube-filled cellulose because you might get a little bit better R factor with high-density cellulose than with batting. And The other thing you can take a look at, if it is accessible, is take a look at foam insulation on the sloped ceiling areas, isonine foam, urethane foam. So talk to it three or four different insulation contractors. I don't know where Richfield is. I don't know if you've got a larger city nearby where you're going to have a bunch of people you can call. But it doesn't cost anything to have contractors out and get advice from them, and you will already be educated from looking at the core event.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Email from Ellie asking, what siding material is best for an 80-year-old home which has no insulation in the walls, a vinyl, steel, aluminum, or cement?
Well, that's a very good question. Part of it depends on your budget, but if you're going to do some new siding, it would be a very good time to have an energy audit done on your home, decide if your house is a good candidate for blown-in cellulose insulation or some other form of insulation. If your home is... I didn't catch how old your home was.
80 years.
80 years. So there may or may not be inadequate wiring in the walls. So before you wire it, you want to have an electrician come over and give you an assessment of any kind of wiring upgrades that you might want to have. Then when it comes to siding it, it's basically what you can afford. I tend to lean away from vinyl for a variety of reasons. One is PVC is hazardous to the people that manufacture it. It's got a relatively limited life of useful life as a siding, and then when it's all said and done, you put it in the landfill, and it also still outgasses VOC. So I sort of lean away from it, even though its initial cost is very good, or at least seems to be very good. My favorite of the sidings that you mentioned probably would have to say cement board. And it's not outrageously expensive. You can get a 20-year warranty on some of the colors that they give you, and it's so you won't have to worry about painting it for at least two decades, unless you don't like the color. And it holds up to Wisconsin abuse. So that would be a good place to start.
Yep. There you go. Thank you very much. So, Jim Packard lets me know that the State Lab of Hygiene or Bureau of Hygiene is... in Madison, of course, as I said, it's 465 Henry Mall. 465 Henry Mall, Madison, 53706, the zip code. My mom worked at the State Lab of Hygiene and did lots of those tests over the years for a whole variety of things.
I didn't know that.
Be it rabies or whatever, there she was testing it. Oh, did that for many, many years. Jim in Onalaska, it is your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Okay, my house is... just about 100 years old, with a stone foundation. And the foundation is not in the greatest shape in all the spots in the basement. You know, there's places where the mortar is kind of coming off. You know, you can brush your fingers across it, and it'll just come off real easily in some places where I need to fill some holes in. And I'd like to fix it out. I don't want to finish the basement, but I want to fix the walls up a little bit so they aren't crumbling and I don't have all this sand coming in all the time and stuff like that. I do have a problem in that there's a spring behind the house, so it's I think the water table's pretty high. the basement, if I don't run my dehumidifier, will literally hit 100% humidity in the basement.
Wow.
I'm not sure exactly how to go about fixing the walls and at the same time making sure that they're going to breathe properly and stuff.
Jim, I'm assuming, you said the walls are stone. Now, most stone foundations are what we call sandstone. It's actually a light type of limestone. Is that what you have, or is it actually the round field stones?
It's a combination.
Oh, it is?
Mostly it's flatter stuff, but there is some round stuff in it, too.
A few round sediment.
Yeah, I think they gathered, it's an old farm, I guess they gathered whatever they had on the farm.
Okay. Most likely, well, actually not most likely, certainly, if it's a 100-year-old foundation, it's got a lime-based mortar, not a Portland cement-based mortar. And old stone, especially that limestone, has a tendency to move, and you've got a really wet basement. So you've got those walls have to be able to breathe or they're going to break up. So what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to make mortar with a very limited Portland cement a mixture in it, and mostly lime for the bonder. And you can simply mix mix sand and lime, and maybe one-third of the bonder could be a Portland cement. You'll find that lime mortars are really easy to work with. They stick very easily. You can pack it in nice and tight, and the cleanup is easy. It's much easier to work with than with the hard, modern Portland cement mortars. If you email me at frei@chorus.net, and chorus is spelled like a group of singers, I will send you a specification on how to mix the mortar, how much of the loose stuff to remove, etc. I've done this for many, many buildings, and my specifications are approved for historic work. Be happy to send that to you, and if you have any follow-up questions, be happy to answer those for you as well.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. And we'll turn to Norman in Wausau next. Hi, Norman.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have two quick questions for your guests. One is, we've had a Renew air interchanger in our basement for about 8 years. It's got a Mitsubishi cell, I believe is what they call it, in it. And for about the last 4 years, not on the intake side, but it would be, I think, on the outlet from the air that's coming from in the house part, there's more and more mold, black mold, getting on that, I think it looks like a resinous packed filter. Is there any good way of taking it out? They do mention in the thing that you're not supposed to wet it. You're just supposed to vacuum it. But that doesn't seem to get rid of much of it.
Okay. Ken, do you want to take a shot at that one?
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the unit, although I've put in several heat exchangers over the years. Is it reasonable to think that it might be time to replace the filter, for one thing? Another thing is, you may, if you're going to replace the filter, you may want to have the lines, the tube, it's probably 6-inch round tube leaning to an intake, you might want to have that cleaned out, because there's a chance there might be some mold in that before the heat exchanger, because you're blowing out warm, moist air. So it's a wonderful place for molds to grow. It probably won't hurt anything to have a little bit of mold in there because it is escaping. But yeah, it would be a good idea to make sure that it's not going to continue to grow.
If it's 8 years old, probably about time actually to have a heating technician come and check it over.
Yeah, because, tweak the system.
Yeah, if the system gets clogged enough with dirt and mold, it will simply burn itself out, and that's a sort of expensive replacement. So, I think you're up in Wausau, so you've got all kinds of good heating contractors up there. I think I'd probably have that professionally looked at, Norman.
Okay. Yeah. The second question on our electric heater, and we've had this happen with successive heaters. We get a lime, I believe it's a lime or calcium precipitate around the bottom heating element, and then some of it falls down as kind of chunks into the bottom of the thing. And after a while, of course, that lower heating element has really got a problem,
right,
because it's
right
on all the time and it can't heat very well. What's the best way of dealing with that? They say to drain your thing, but hell, you can't drain out the stuff that's big, large chunks, you know.
No, you can't, but I did a home inspection once, and the gentleman had lived there for 65 years.
Oh.
And he had a General Motors, I think it was, electric water heater, And he had bought it when he moved into the house. And he drained a gallon of water out of that water heater every single week. And that thing was 60 years old and still functioning. Absolutely amazing. But you're right. Now, do you have a water softener in your house, Norman?
No, we do not. Our water is about medium in terms of hardness or softness.
Okay.
We did have it checked.
Well, a softener is certainly going to help. I mean, otherwise, all you can do is you can pull that next time that element goes out, change that lower element, clean the water heater out. They have delimers that you can use. And you may want to then do what this old gentleman did. I'm not weekly, but maybe at least once a month, go down and drain some of the sediment off of the bottom. Probably give you a little more life. It's an intractable problem. The other thing to take a look at is look at your electricity bills. If that heater costs quite a bit to operate, we still have this 30% energy credit. If you've got natural gas available, maybe it's time to go to a side-vented gas heater. So take a look at that as well. Check with Focus on Energy, take a look at the credits and the rebates available, and maybe it's time to go to something that uses a little bit less, takes a little bit less out of your pocketbook to heat the water.
On those delimers, is there any specific one or way that you have to use it?
Well,
it's
there's
like
just
that, LCR stuff, you know, for
CLR,
taking stuff out of your toilet bowl and stuff. Was that the kind of thing you're thinking about?
There actually are some commercial ones, and I can't remember the names of them anymore at this point. But you're probably going to have to check with a branch of one of the Huffman Chemicals or one of the janitorial commercial suppliers. I don't think this is something you're going to get at a hardware store.
Okay.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And we'll turn to Mark in Wauwatosa next. Mark, hello.
Hello, hi. Yeah, I hear so many callers call in. They talk about things like pests and mold and moisture problems. And sometimes insulation, you know, comes up in that discussion. And you had an earlier caller with pests and carpenter ants. I wonder if you guys have heard of this product. It's an insulation called Aircrete. With a K, and it's I see them on the internet here. It's www.aircrete, AIRKRETE.com, and I'm interested in possibly becoming a factory trained installer for this product here in the Milwaukee area, I just wonder if you guys have heard of this. It's this high R value, completely fireproof. It's inorganic. It sounds crazy, but it's actually a cement foam. It's an all-purpose insulation that basically it's kind of like instead of soap bubbles, it's Portland concrete bubbles, and it can either pump into existing walls. Even old window weight pockets, it'll harden into this. It actually becomes it's a brittle foam, but it's not so brittle. I mean, you don't usually go inside your wall cavities again. If you want to chase new wires through there someday, you can still do it. I suppose just replace whatever you damage, but it's. It's pretty intriguing, and I want to make sure if I do this that I get into, you know, something good. But I'm just really intrigued by this. It's no dangerous chemicals, no off-gassing. It's not polymer or petroleum-based.
Now, I don't know anything about it, but I would like to know what the R value is of it, first of all.
3.9.
3.9 for a standard wall thickness,
yeah.
Or for a one inch thick?
Per inch.
Per inch. So that's marginal. I mean,
yeah, it's certainly not nearly as high as a urethane type foam or an isonine foam.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of the concerns I have with this, Mark, is that I think what this is a super lightweight concrete with a lot of air entrained into it.
Sounds right.
And what is really providing the insulation is the tiny little air bubbles that are through the material, but this is a wet material. So we're introducing quite a bit of moisture, I would think, into the wall systems. I'm a little bit concerned with that. The other thing we have to take a look at is shrinkage over time. I think no one else around here is as old as I am, but I think I remember when formaldehyde foam was the big thing to use back in the 60s and early 70s. Mm-hmm. And it, again, was a brittle foam, had a lot of air in it. And what we found is that it shrunk so much that it was a very poor insulator, because once the whatever the vehicle was left, so I'm a little bit concerned about the aircrete, is once the moisture leaves, as Ken was saying earlier, all concrete cracks. Well, this is a concrete, and if it has a lot of moisture in it, I'm wondering if it may end up fracturing and shrinking so that you would have air cold spots going through the wall. I don't know whether Building and Safety in Madison would be a place to call to see whether they have studied it. University of Wisconsin, Engineering Department, Material Science. But if you're looking at something, I would get into it very, very carefully and look for some academic research. You might be able to email Building Science in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to see if Joel Stilbeck or John Carmody has studied it, because those guys are some of the top people in the country for moisture and insulation questions. So I would do some real searching. The R factor of 3.9 per inch is not great. So I'm not sure why somebody would purchase this rather than a high-density cellulose or some other sort. So don't spend money getting yourself into a business that might be problematical or that isn't viable.
Yeah.
Do your research.
Do your research.
Yeah. Thanks Good. For calling,
Good
Mark.
Good luck.
Chuck in Fitchburg, on to you now. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. We have a cedar roof that we have some trouble with ice dams and wonder how you prevent that. This cedar is fairly new. Larry, you probably remember when we had the hailstorms here.
Oh, yeah.
A couple years ago. So that's how old the cedar is. We have one area that just has, last year was even dripping in, and we took the snow off, but we wonder if there's some way to prevent this from happening.
Well, cedar is a self-venting roof. Usually people have very few problems with cedar roofs. Now, these are cedar sawn shingles, not cedar shakes.
Cedar shakes, yeah.
Oh, they're the shakes. Okay.
The shakes, I think.
Yeah, the shakes are not self-venting because they've got the layers of felt underneath them. So,
right.
Yeah, there with the cedar, if ice and water shield was not put down for the lower 6 feet or so, you are indeed going to have problems. And, of course, they probably didn't want to put the ice and water shield down because that limits the drying. So the cedar shake roofs, you really do have a bit of a problem. If you put on the ice and water shield, the roof doesn't last as long. If you don't put on the ice and water shield, you're apt to get leaks. So it's just a little bit of a dilemma, Chuck, with no real good solution other than getting out there with that snow rake as soon as you can and pull that snow off.
That's what we're doing. Okay, and this year we haven't had any trouble, but thought maybe we're pretty sure that these electrical fixture gizmos are probably not appropriate for a wood roof either. Is that right?
Well, I don't think they're ever appropriate.
Oh, they are.
Chuck, you're going to want to check the insulation values in your house. I think an energy audit, even if it's a newer house, you may want to have done, because if the snow is melting, that means you've got excessive heat loss up into the attic. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So why don't you start out with an energy audit on the house? It could be that you're going to greatly reduce your problem by simply having more insulation. You might have some air leaks up into the attic that would be easy to stop, that a blower door test will find. You can do a little thermal imaging and of course it's still nice and cold out, which is when the thermal imaging works best. But I would get right on an energy audit. I think you're probably going to save money in many different ways, as well as decrease the ice damming.
Good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And more callers. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee next. Mike, hello to you.
Oh, hi. I have a house that is constructed of Cream City brick, which is at least 80 years old. The house is 80 years old, but I think the brick was reclaimed. And I'd like to know what kind of mortar needs to be used for tuck pointing, because I've heard various things that if you use the wrong kind of mortar, it's going to crack this brick, which is relatively soft brick. I don't know if your guests are familiar with this kind of brick, which is sort of indigenous to the Milwaukee area.
Very familiar with it, Mike. In fact, if you would like a couple, approximately a million of them, we have them available. They're on the south side of Milwaukee. All you have to do is take them off the church. But you're completely correct. This is a very soft brick, and we have to use a lime mortar. As I was talking to Jim there up in Onalaska, and I can make the same offer to you if you'll email me at frei@chorus.net. I will send you the mixing formulas, and all of the specifications for tuck pointing your house. This is something you can do yourself. You can actually go down to Chicago and take a course, if you like, at U.S. Heritage Masonry. Take a one-day course, three-day course, or five-day course, and do your own house. They will teach you how to mix lime putty and slake lime and hydrated lime mortars and how to tuck point, and it's really sort of fun. I took the course years ago. I already knew how to lay brick, but I still learned a lot of things.
There you have it, Mike.
Could you repeat the U.S. Heritage and also your email address?
Yeah, it's U.S. Heritage Masonry, and I think you just Google them. They're going to pop up. And
okay.
Our email is frei@chorus.net. And chorus is spelled like a group of singers, CHORUS. I'd be happy to send those specifications out to you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we have some open lines finally again, so you can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest today, Ken Adams of Adams Design and Construction in Madison, John Freiberger of Freiberger Consulting of Fitchburg, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some more calls now as we talk home renovation, repair, and water inspection issues with Ken Adams and John Freiberger. Jeannie in Brown Deer up next. Hi, Jeannie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I wanted to replace the parquet flooring in our kitchen, dining room, foyer, mudroom, and bathroom. And so we had someone come out to do the measurements and the specifications. And the recommendation was that we needed to have a new subfloor put in. And the guy who was here thought that it was particle board that is the subfloor right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if you had any idea what the cost would be to have a new subfloor so that we could have a new floor put in, or is there a floor that we could put in that's not a wood floor but not replace the subfloor?
Right. Well, your contractor was appropriate if you're going to put in a wood floor, and if it's going to be nailed to the subfloor, particle board will not work. It will fail, and it won't take long. So do that, I'm sorry?
I was going to say our current floor is very wavy,
yeah,
and like brittle in some places because of the unevenness.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, he's probably right. You'll have to replace that. If the subfloor is uneven, you're going to have to do something to prep it. If it's the the particle board or wafer board, it would be best to remove it and put down some good quality plywood underlayment. If you're trying to save some money and the floor is fairly even, you might be able to get away with one of the floating floors that are out there. And Pergo comes to mind. There are some floating plywood wood floors that are out there. So you could check around to the local distributors, the stores fronts, and see if you can find something else that would work. But your contractor's speaking appropriately.
All right.
Okay, so you said check for a floating floor.
Well, floating floor is one of those. I don't know if you've heard of Pergo. It's a snap-in laminate flooring that floats on top of your subfloor. It's not actually fastened to the floor. It's fastened to each other, and the whole floor moves as a unit. There are also wood products that are like that too, plywood products, and that might work for you. So you could just, if you go to a flooring supplier and ask them to describe the difference, they can walk you through it and show you the products, and you'll understand it pretty clearly once you see it. It's not very difficult to understand once you see the products.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And let's go to Bob in Oshkosh. Bob, hello.
Hello. How's it going today?
Just great. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a question, and it's concerning the spray foam insulation. Some of the seminars and things that we've gone to, and I'm kind of asking for these folks' expertise. The newest thing that I've heard with the spray foam insulation is that they're recommending spraying it in steps because of the temperature and affecting the casing on NM wire. I'm an electrician, so I guess my concern is if this is something they've recently discovered, is what about the homes that have all been spray foamed? You know, are we running into issues with wiring issues?
Well, I haven't seen any wiring issues from it, and most of the time when you do apply foam, you have to put it on in layers. You can't just, you know, squirt the hose in and just lay it on there. You spray it on like you would a very thick thick paint, something with a lot of viscosity, and then it expands out. Otherwise, you create all kinds of problems, heat being one of them, but also what's probably most important to contractors is a great deal of waste on a very expensive product. So they're going to be very careful about how much they put on. So anyway, to make a short answer shorter, I haven't seen any issues yet. Have you, John?
I have not, and my experience is the same. I haven't, as long as I've seen people apply it, I've seen it applied in thin layers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
What they're recommending, at least what I've been told now, is that they're recommending spray foam half of a thickness, and then putting down, and then putting batting.
There are some people that recommend that, and I know that there are some new codes that are, if they haven't come into play yet, they are about to, that speak to those issues. So you might want to see what the new codes are going to say. As we start adopting the international standards, we're going to be changing the way we insulate our homes.
Yeah, Bob, we do that quite frequently, where we use a thin layer of foam and then mm-hmm. use cellulose, especially when we are doing attics, as we'll use the foam as the first barrier, because it gives us the air barrier, it gives us the vapor barrier and the thermal barrier, but then we finish it up with the less expensive cellulose. So I think that's a real good way to go, and it is quite cost effective compared to a complete foam cavity.
Yeah, there you have it. Thanks, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. You have another Bob, this one from Cloquet, Minnesota, up next. Bob, hello.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I've got a different situation from what I've been listening to here. I've got new construction. I've got a walkout basement, and I used ICFs, the insulated concrete forms. And as you know, they have screwing strips built in mm-hmm. to those. But they stop near the bottom a couple of inches. And I'm wondering what you would recommend to put trim, how I would put trim, especially baseboard, in finishing a basement that's got the ICFs with half-inch sheetrock over it.
Well, usually when we do basements, we don't put the drywall all the way down to the floor. We'll leave usually an inch or so above the floor, so if there is a little bit of moisture, it won't wick up into the drywall and destroy it. It's not going to hurt the foam.
Okay, I've got a half inch that I raised it.
You know, that's likely going to be okay. Yeah, I would say that would probably be fine. And you could do the same thing with the wood trim. The trim probably should not be touching the floor. You just leave it off the floor. You probably find it doesn't even need to be a full half inch off. But just enough so that it's not sitting solid on the floor. If you can reach your furring strips to be able to get either a nail or a finishing screw into it, that's great. If not, you might have to use a combination of some sort of mechanical fastener and some adhesive.
Is there a particular kind of adhesive that would work better than others?
Well, it has to be safe for the foam, because some construction adhesives will eat up the foam. So you got to be careful. Just read the label.
It wouldn't be touching the foam, I don't think. It would just be touching
the sheetrock. then probably a good construction adhesive would just work just fine. There's some great ones out there that are instant grab now, so you could spread it onto the material, and when you push it on, it holds. It doesn't cure right away, but it holds in place. So I want to say Loctite makes them.
Well, okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. And Betsy and Ripon, your turn. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. I have a dry, well, I was told it was a dry drain, but I'm not sure. It's a sink, and it smells of mildew all the time. And I was told by a construction person, this is a new house. Well, new house, about 3 years old. And it is, it's to pour bleach in it for 6 weeks once a day. And I just heard you talk about bleach, and I thought, oh, maybe I better find out if there's a better way.
When you say dry drain, is it a sink that you don't use very often?
No, we do use it, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I'll just say it's the drain.
Okay. Could it be that there's no pea trap underneath it?
No, what kind of trap?
Well, you know, when you look under your sink, you'll see a little, it looks like a horseshoe, the pipe.
Elbows.
Looks like an elbow, yes. It looks like
I'll look.
180-degree elbow.
No, yeah. There's an elbow.
Okay. So so then there is an elbow there to trap sewer gases from coming
in.
Well,
except that there's such a thing, there's a thing called a double trap.
Yeah.
Where the water comes into the J trap, and then it immediately, after it comes out of the J trap, it falls. And that falling water, if there's not a horizontal piece in between, can actually suck enough water out of the trap.
Yep.
So sewer gas can come up.
That's a good, yeah.
So I think, Betsy, you may just want to have local plumber take a look at this. It could be that your trap is partially emptying of water so that you're getting getting smells up through there.
Yeah, it smells like sewer gas.
Yeah, and that's not good. No, we don't want to be dumping bleach into everything. It's it's hard on the environment and hard on septic systems and the city sewer. But it sounds like you might have a little problem, so have your local plumber come over, and it might very well be a 15-minute fix.
Oh, okay. And it's called a double trap?
A double trap, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. May I ask another question?
Sure.
And that is, in our walls, we had blown, I don't know if it's cellulose, but it's paper in the wall.
It's probably cellulose, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And but we have noticed in the basement that the mice love it. And I'm always finding little piles, when...
You shouldn't have cellulose exposed in the basement.
Oh.
So is it sort of a grayish color paper?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it shouldn't be exposed in the basement. Did they put it in the ring joists, or where is it in the basement?
Well, actually, they told us when they did it, they did the walls all over the house, and then they started the construction people started to put the kind that's batting, and the people who put the cellulose in said, "Ooh, they shouldn't have done that. They should have allowed us to finish the job." And so they then they came back and then they blew some more in.
So this is a case of the left hand not knowing what the right hand's doing.
Exactly.
Is any of this insulation exposed now?
You can hardly see because there's piping over it.
Mm-hmm.
Open piping, for the going into the furnace and stuff. There's big boxes of metal, and it comes through one of those.
Well,
boy,
it's tough.
That's one you have to have a look at, I think.
The first, I guess, one thing you want to do is see if you could figure out a way to eliminate mice.
Yep.
That's very difficult because they could fit into very small openings. But if you can do that, that would help. And the second thing is, if there's a way.
And I do have that sticky board.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Well, Betsy, I think you've got a hole in your house someplace.
Yeah.
Several of them.
Yeah.
What happens in the winter if you've got a nice little air leak? The mice find the warm air and then they'll follow that in or chew their way in.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you may want to look both outside and inside the house, like where your gas pipes come through the wall, where the water outside faucets go through the wall,
sometimes
your dryer
right
goes
at
through
the
bottom
wall. Of the siding too.
When we do home inspections, you can turn off the lights in the basement, and I will see light coming in all kinds of places. People will have a lot of holes in their house.
Okay.
And if you go around and patch them, I'm in a 150-year-old farmhouse, and I don't get mice because I've gone around and patched all those holes.
Yeah.
Okay,
and with new construction, you should have a complete air barrier on the exterior of the house, so where you've got a wall penetration, let's get those sealed up, and then the cats can just live on cat food.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
For calling. Appreciate your call very much. Have you guys been busy, by the way? Business just in these economic times, things picking up a bit?
I have been tremendously busy.
Oh, great.
Some houses are selling, but we are dealing with all of the construction problems from the construction boom, where
okay.
anybody could buy a hammer and a pickup truck and say, I'm a general contractor.
Yeah, and we went last summer was really a busy time for us and for most of my competitors and compatriots in the business, and things dropped off. We've had kind of a slow winter, but it hasn't been sitting around waiting for the mail kind of thing. But things are really picking up now. A lot of people are getting interested in spring projects, and we're seeing a lot of activity now. So
if you're thinking about projects, this might be a time to start looking at some of the contractors in your area. Our guests today, Ken Adams and John Freiberger, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network as we talk home renovation, repair, and water and inspection issues with Ken Adams of Adams Design and Construction and John Freiberger of Freiberger Consulting of Fitchburg. Call us at 1-800-642-1234, and Robert in Madison has done that, so let's go to Robert. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a contractor, and occasionally I install vinyl siding. And within the past year, I started installing a walkable PVC membrane. When you heat weld that, it does give off some fumes. I wondered if the guests could talk a little bit more about any health implications from either the manufacturer of siding or from other PVC or installation. And I'll take my answer off there.
All right. Thank you.
Well, first of all, good luck. This season, Robert. I hope you have a good one. The PVC, my understanding of it is that when it's in its solid form, in the short term, it's not going to be, it's not considered hazardous. It's not off-gassing VOCs. It's in the manufacturer. It's at the melting temperature, which is fairly low. I mean, if you're welding seams, you're probably... I want to say it's 280 degrees or something like that is a welding temperature. It's fairly low. Then you're getting more outgassing, so you want to protect yourself from the gases. And then over time is where it's an issue when you put it back in the landfill, when it's lived its life, and it just slowly gases out the VOCs. That's the extent of my knowledge. If you want more information, you'll have to do some research. John may know someplace he's sort of... looking through his notes, and maybe we'll come up with something before the end of the show. But I'll come up with something for some more information for next time we do the show.
All right. Great. Thanks again for calling. And Scott in Brookfield, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hear you gentlemen each show talk about the focus on energy, and I am one who had it done and am very satisfied with it. So
great.
I thought I would just relate my experience so maybe I could encourage others to do the same thing. I think it was a worthwhile program. I had the audit done in 2008, and it's like anything else when you select one of the vendors, you know, check your credentials. You know, the ones that I selected were approved by NARI, Focus on Energy. You checked Better Business Bureau, and the insulation contractors, too. They all did great work. I was really happy with them. And they found lots of areas in the house, some that I knew about, other areas I was like, didn't know about that. We had the insulation done, and we also installed a tankless water heater, did a couple other things. So they just came back and did the re-audit, and what was nice about it was there was no charge for the retest to come back and do it. And it's also now I'm eligible for, I think, like $1,000 worth of rebates from We Energies, which is our local utility provider here. So, and the other nice thing about it is since we had all the work done, we've seen about a third cut, not in the gas price, but in our gas usage, which is from last year, from last winter. So I've been really happy with that. And I've also recommended them to a couple neighbors. I know at least one of which has also done it as well. So I just think it's a great program that more people should take advantage of. And it wasn't very expensive. It was like under $250 to have the test come in and be completed initially. Yeah.
That's fantastic. See, everybody, listen to Scott. He's right on the money. I agree with everything he said, and I'm happy to hear about it.
That's one of those state programs that really works
well. It really is a good thing.
Yeah, it is a fantastic program, and I would highly recommend it. And just from a one-third cut this year from gas usage through last winter at this time is just phenomenal. And, you know, with prices going up in energy, you can't go wrong.
Plus, yeah, absolutely.
Plus, you're protecting the value of your home. If and when you come to sell it, you've got these credentials on the house now that will really show some value.
Well, and then you've got documentation too of what you've done. So
exactly.
That's real big. So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Scott.
Good. Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. I agree 100% with his comments, and I know my guests do as well. Dick in Pittsville, on to you now. Hi, Dick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I have a log home. It's constructed with studs and 4-inch pine siding. It's 19 years old. And I've used stain sealer on it as a finishing coat, and I still have knots bleeding on the south side of the house after 19 years. Do you can recommend anything that I can put on to stop the bleeding?
I don't think so, Dick. The problem is on the south side, that wood is heating up, and it is changing sap and things that's in there to viscosity, and where you have your knots, that is where your cell structure is pointed outward. So, and of course, the darker the stain you have, the more heat you get and the more bleeding you get. I don't know anything that's really going to seal that because you're getting pretty good pressure inside. They're building up pushing on it.
Yeah. I've never heard of anything.
What are the prices to pay to have beautiful siding? Not siding.
It looks really good right after I stain it.
Yeah, what we actually recommend when people use that type of siding now is that they put on what's called a rain screen system, where the wall is actually back vented, so you've got a 1-inch airspace between the siding and the exterior sheathing of your house. And what we find then is that really lowers the temperature. That heat is able to move into that airspace, and so we get less bleeding of knots with that type of siding or with any kind of siding.
No.
Rain screen construction is wonderful if you use wood.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling. Too late for you, but for anybody else, that's sure something to think about. Jim and Irma, we're on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm remodeling about 120-year-old building in the old downtown of Tomahawk, and I'm putting on the ceiling in the upstairs was originally lath and plaster, and then they built another ceiling underneath that out of 2x4s in the 1940s and put 2x4 panels of cellulose, rigid cellulose, and then plastered over that. Well, that's all cracked and not looking good, so I'm going to put another layer of sheetrock over that ceiling, and I'm wondering, do I need to put a vapor barrier in there? And the same question on a couple of exterior walls. Do we need vapor barriers under the new sheetrock? And then how important is it I want to blow cellulose above that attic when I'm all done. How important is it that attic space is vented?
Okay. Real good questions, Jim, but I want to throw one more at you.
Mm-hmm.
What is the structural strength of that ceiling that you're now going to add a third layer to?
It's going to carry it. I'm
it
pretty
is.
Sure. I was up there crawling around, and that was a good question because, that's something to consider.
No, it is, because as we add these layers, you know what that sheetrock weighs when you carry it upstairs.
Yep.
And we hang that all on a ceiling. And these old buildings, you get some of these old balloon frame buildings that are a century old, and they might not be too strong. But, yes, you certainly do want to have a vapor barrier on everything. So on the ceiling, you can simply put up a polyethylene sheet vapor barrier.
Hey.
On the walls, if you're restoring the plaster, you can use a vapor barrier paint. If you're restoring the plaster and it's in sort of bad shape, you can use a system like Glidden makes one. I think they call it Glidwall system, where you put on a vapor barrier paint, a fiberglass sheet, and another layer of vapor barrier paint, and then you texture it, and it bridges all the cracks and gives you a vapor barrier as well. But it will be important to try to reduce the amount of moisture that is moving through the attic. You're going to want to vent for multiple reasons. You want to get the moisture out so you don't get condensation, but you want to get the summer heat out as well as the winter heat, so we don't have a lot of snow melt.
Right.
Is this a flat-roofed building?
No, it's a wedge shape. It's probably 4 feet at the street side, and then drops down to nothing on the 60-foot run.
Okay.
And it's a real bear to work in, of course. And yeah. One of my concerns was, if I load that up with sheetrock and then load it up with cellulose above that, add another, I don't know what a pounds per square foot that is. The weight issue was there's one room that's got a 20-foot span. The other rooms are bedrooms, and they're small enough to they're only 12-foot.
Well, we were talking about urethane insulations earlier, and this is one of those places where maybe if the whole ceiling came down, where you've got no space to work in, you could get air chutes in there, vent everything uphill towards the front of the building where you've got the height, because that's going to give you sort of the natural, nice natural flow.
Right.
And then use urethane, get up to R44 until you can switch to the urethane with a blown-in cellulose on top of it system that we were discussing earlier. That's going to give you a really nice, tight system.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Sarah in Middleton says, I'm hoping you can resolve a debate between my husband and myself. Our dining room is carpeted and we have small children, so you can imagine the mess. My husband wants us to scrub it frequently or use a steam cleaner, whereas I want to rip up the carpet and put in anything else, maybe laminate flooring because it's cheap, because I think the carpeting is unsanitary and the chemicals are dangerous for our small kids. Can you help me win the argument?
Absolutely.
Ken?
It's Valentine's Day. The wife is right. No question about it. But beyond that, If you're talking about holding dust and dirt and that sort of thing, tearing out the carpet, putting in either a wood or a laminate floor, tile floor, is going to be a lot cleaner. What happens, you get little dust bunnies in the corner, but and then you can wipe them up, but it's much cleaner than having carpet typically, especially if you've got kids, pets, and so forth. It's not quite as warm on the feet, but if you thought about, maybe you can use an in-floor heating system if you've got the money, or, just wear warm socks, you'd be happy with it. I'm with you.
All right. Let's go to Anthony and Stevens Point then. Anthony, hello.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, we got this, bought a house, and the inspector took a look at it, and really the only thing he had concern about was that our dryer in the basement vents into the garage, and since we've been living here, I really noticed the moisture building up in the garage when the dryer's on, especially now that it's cold. I was wondering if you had any suggestions. If I put a beeline to the quickest exit instead of the garage, you'd go out kind of towards the front of the house by the front door. I really don't want to do that. Is there a problem with having a dryer vent into the garage like that?
Yes, it's specifically a code violation in a new house. It's simply not allowed. You've got a couple of issues. You have the moisture issue, but also, if you have an attached garage, you really want to have a one-hour fire barrier. And, of course, a hole in the wall for a dryer vent is something you can't have in a fire barrier. So I would look for some way of getting it outside. Remember that if you've got to go a ways, you're probably going to want to use an oversized ductwork so that you don't get a lot of drag in the system. But I think pretty important to get that dryer vented to the exterior. If it's a gas dryer or electric dryer, it makes a little bit of a difference. A gas dryer, you can get some higher temperatures, so there are a few more restrictions on the type of material you use for the ducting.
Electric dryer?
Electric dryer, lower temperatures, but for any long run, you're probably going to actually want to at least call a local heating contractor and say, what should I use to make sure that this thing is going to vent well. I'm not going to get a lot of lint buildup inside the ductwork.
Super. Is there a minimum diameter of piping I'd want to use to get that vented out the side? I've got to run about 20 feet.
Around 20 feet. Well, you should probably go online to check the installation instructions for the dryer that you have. If you've got the original information, it's going to talk about the number of BTUs, the power of the fan, etc. There's a lot. You know, there's so many differences between dryers nowadays, from the El Cheapos that don't do much to the sort that I have in my house, where it's almost like light commercial.
Don't forget, too, every elbow is equivalent to adding another 15 feet of run. So if you have two elbows, that's like having 30 feet of run.
I've got two elbows. Well, looks like I got to make a call to the local HVAC guy.
Yeah, that'd be a good.
That's a good way to go.
Thanks so much for your help.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Ken emailed and says, I live in a large, 125-year-old, fairly well-insulated home in La Crosse. If we were to lose power for an extended period of time in winter, I imagine that I ought to drain water lines and dump automotive antifreeze in toilets and sink traps. What guidelines do you suggest for temperatures and length of power outage before undertaking this procedure? Boy.
Well, if it's a well-insulated house, it's going to really depend upon the temperature differential between the outside and the inside. Houses can stay above freezing for an extended period of time. It does take quite a while for that. I mean, they'll cool from 70 down to 50 pretty quick, but it takes quite a while for them to fall all the way down to 32.
Plus, if we have pets and us in the house, we're generating a little bit of heat.
That is,
too,
we are. So that is correct. I know I have friends in Iowa that had power out for 5 days in the ice storm here a few weeks ago, and that really does become problematical. Whoa. I think what I would probably do is just I wouldn't be too concerned about it until you get down below 40 degrees, and then I would go ahead and start winterizing. But it seems in Wisconsin that we're just awfully good at getting the power back on here within a day or two. We live out in the country; we do get power outages, and for some reason, it never seems to go more than a few hours, even during the ice storms.
Yeah.
Another thing, if you wanted to keep some antifreeze around for a purpose like this, I wouldn't use car antifreeze. There are antifreezes made for water systems, RV systems. You can pick up a couple gallons and throw it in a corner in the basement and use that. It's a little better for the environment, a little safer for you.
Well, certainly, if Ken's on a septic system, that is going to be very important.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
You'd hate to have him destroy the entire septic system trying to keep the house from freezing.
And, yeah, it's
yes. That would get expensive. We have an email from another person who says, I've seen Homes on Homes, the show where they seek absolute vapor barrier in basement remodels. I live in Brookfield, and the inspectors want the CMUs in the basement to breathe, so no vapor barrier. Mm-hmm. Holmes also tapes everything tight, even solid insulation. Since Homes on Homes is always in Canada, what's the difference in their installation styles? Why is it so different? By the way, he says he likes this show a lot.
Well, that's nice. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure. I've never seen Homes on Homes.
I haven't either.
So I'm not really sure exactly what they're recommending. On the exterior of a building, certainly both we and the Canadians want to seal everything as tightly as possible to limit the amount of air intrusion coming into a house. So there we are being very careful to tape. In fact, we're even putting on double barriers on a lot of houses, a barrier under the sheathing, another barrier over the top of the sheathing to keep the wind from not whistling through the walls. On the inside of the house, that is correct. We do not want vapor barriers in our basement because we get a lot of pints of moisture coming through concrete walls. You can get you can get up to 105 pints a day of moisture coming through a basement wall if you have wet soil around the house, and putting a vapor barrier in there would lead to tremendous condensation and a disaster. So yes, we do certainly want things tight above grade on the inside with our interior vapor barrier, and we do want it tight on the exterior as far as our wind barrier. And a cold climate is a cold climate, and Wisconsin is a cold climate, and there's really no difference between mm-hmm. here and Canada. So I really wouldn't mm-hmm. expect there to be any real difference.
You know, one of the things the Canadians have been sort of espousing for a while is not insulating a basement, but insulating the ground away from the basement. So you're keeping the ground next to the foundation relatively warm. If you can imagine digging a hole at roughly a 45-degree angle from the top of the foundation out away from the house down to below the frost line and putting 3 inches of foam insulation and then covering that back up, what you're going to have is everything on the outside of that insulation could be frozen, and everything on the inside will be much warmer. And that's one way to keep a foundation warm and eliminate needing to have to put insulation on the inside of the house. Very expensive to do if you're building a house. It's a great super insulation technique.
And gas water heaters. Looking at a gas water heater, and even with tax rebates, the highest efficiency water heaters are still pretty expensive. He was looking at an A.O. Smith. But are there? Is it worth it to get the highest efficiency gas water heater?
It is pretty amazing. You can spend $1,700 on a water heater, but I I think you can also get a pretty good water heater for about half of that. The other thing that you need to take a look at is there's energy savings, but sometimes there's other issues as well. Just did a home inspection yesterday, where the water heater is vented into an old metal Class B chimney, which was just fine, except that there's a 1-inch airspace going around this chimney all the way through the house into the attic. So not only were we venting the water heater to the exterior through the roof, we were venting the warm air in the basement up into the attic. So this house had tremendous ice dams. So you really need to look at it as a system. Are you just saving the money and getting the rebate for the hot water heating, or are you going to reduce things like condensation and warm air going into the attic in the winter? So sometimes you end up saving more than you think, depending upon how you analyze the system.
All right. And Chris in Platteville, you have a quick question?
Yes. I just recently had a pole building built, and it was put on top of an ICF foundation, insulated concrete form foundation.
Okay.
And mice got into the corners where we haven't finished off the inside yet. And I sealed off the corners with some boards, but they seemed to then chew through the foam of the ICF and go under the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they love that stuff.
Yeah, they love that stuff. We got about 40 seconds or so to answer that. Anything you can do?
Well, you can seal it. The best way you can seal it, caulking, sealing with wood, try to blow some foam in where they've chewed it out, seal the gaps on the outside. I don't know what else to add.
The ICF on the exterior by code needs to be completely covered with a cementous or a ground break. Because otherwise that foam is going to break down just due to sunlight.
Yeah.
So you need to go around that whole thing and cover it. Check glass steel ground break or the cement type stuff. But once you get either – I got a lot of mice, but they don't chew through steel. Once you get the steel or concrete on there, those little critters are going to stay out.
All right. There you have it. And, guys, thanks so much. You'll be back again, I hope, and do this again.
Happy Valentine's Day, yes.
Yes, to you guys as well. Ken Adams of Adams Design and Construction in Madison specializes in residential renovation projects, and John Freiberger of Freiberger Consulting of Fitchburg consults for historic restoration projects and water and mold litigation. He's a registered home inspector as well. So really pleased to have them back. And they will be back, and we will do this again with them. Really good show today. Thank you so much. Looking ahead, Garden Talk tomorrow, Bob Tomish, senior lecturer in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture, will be our guest. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.